I always feel the same way when I give a talk. I consider myself as simply another person, just like those in the audience, same human being. So, I am just one human being talking to other human beings. Similarly, they should consider me as the same human being with the same potential for constructive emotions and destructive emotions. When we meet anyone, first and foremost, we must remember that they too have the same desire to have a happy day, a happy month, a happy life, and all have the right to achieve it. Then, you see, my talk may offer them something relevant. But if I consider myself something special, or if they also consider me something different and special, then my experience will not be of much use. So it's wonderful that in you, Archbishop, I have found a comrade who fully shares this same view.
The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were uninterested in status and superiority. The Dalai Lama began to tell a story that was a poignant reminder that not all shared their view in the religious world.
You have said I am a mischievous person. One day, at a big interfaith meeting in Delhi, one Indian spiritual leader sat there next to me like this.
The Dalai Lama sat up stiffly and made a rigid, scowling face.
He said that his seat should be higher than the others. What do you call this?
The Dalai Lama tapped the base of his chair.
The legs.
Yes, the legs were not long enough, so the organizers had to bring some extra bricks to make this spiritual leader's chair higher. The whole time I sat next to him, he remained immobile like a statue. Then I thought, if one of the bricks were to move and he fell over, then we would see what would happen.
Did you move the brick?
If I had...
I don't believe you.
Maybe you will see some mysterious force move the brick because I will pray to God. Please, just topple that chair. Then that spiritual leader will act like a real human being.
The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were cackling.
As I mentioned earlier, I used to get nervous. When I was young and had to give some formal teachings, because I was not thinking that we were all the same, I would experience anxiety. I would forget that I am just talking as a human being to fellow human beings. I would think of myself as something special, and that kind of thinking would make me feel isolated. It is this sense of separateness that isolates us from other people. In fact, this kind of arrogant way of thinking creates a sense of loneliness and then anxiety. In 1954, just after I reached Beijing on an official visit, the Indian ambassador came to see me. Some Chinese officials were also there. The Chinese communist officials, again, were like statues. Like this. Very serious and reserved. Then, somehow a bowl of fruit on the table toppled over. I don't know what happened. So then, these stern-looking Chinese officials got down on their knees to chase and pick up the fruit. You see, when things go smoothly, then we can pretend we are something very special. But something happens, something unexpected, then we are forced to act like normal human beings.
I began asking another question when the Dalai Lama glanced at a clock that was displaying the wrong time and asked whether it was time for the tea break. I explained that we still had a half hour, but asked the Archbishop, whose energy level we were monitoring closely, whether he needed a break.
No.
You're okay? I asked again, aware that the Archbishop might push himself beyond what would be good for his health.
He's doing very well. He's behaving like a human being.
So, you describe me as a mischievous person. So when I am at a very holy or formal meeting, I truly am thinking that I wish something would go wrong. Now, people are going to know that when the Dalai Lama comes into a room, and maybe he's sitting with presidents, he's looking around and hoping that one of the chairs will break. So that's why, when I first met President Bush, we immediately became close friends on the human level, not official level, human level. We were sitting together when some cookies were served. Then I asked, "Which one is the best?" And he immediately said, pointing to one, "This one is very good." He acted like a normal human being, so we became very close. Some other leaders, when we are meeting, there'll be some distance. Then the second time, little closer. Third time, little closer.
With each time, he was moving his head a little closer to the archbishop.
When I was very young in Lhasa, I used to receive copies of the American magazine called Life. One issue had a picture of Princess Elizabeth, the future queen, at some very big official function. The princess was reading a message with Prince Philip by her side. The wind had blown Her Majesty's skirt like that. Both Princess Elizabeth and Prince Philip pretended like nothing had happened, but an American photographer took the picture. When I saw that picture, I laughed. I really thought it was very funny. Sometimes, especially in formal occasions, people act as if they are different and special. But we all know that we are all the same, ordinary human beings.
Can you explain the role that humility plays in cultivating joy? I asked as the archbishop started laughing.
They tell the story of a bishop who was about to ordain candidates to the priesthood. They were speaking about virtues, including the virtue of humility. One of the candidates came up to the bishop and said, "My lord, I've been looking in the library to find a book on humility." The bishop said, "Oh yes, I've written the best book on the subject."
I thought he might also share the joke he often tells of the three bishops. These three religious leaders were standing before the altar, beating their breasts with great humility, saying how, before God, they were nothing. Shortly, one of the lowly acolytes in the church approached and started to beat his chest, professing that he too was nothing. When the three bishops heard him, one elbowed the other and said, "Look who thinks he's nothing." These stories about false modesty are funny because humility is not something that one can claim to have. It is for this reason that I think that the archbishop was laughing about the question even before I had finished asking it. He did not want to claim to be an expert on humility. Nonetheless, he and the Dalai Lama were saying that humility is essential to a life of joy. And it's exactly this humility that allows these two men to be so approachable, so connected to others, and so effective in their work in the world.
There is a Tibetan prayer which is part of the mind training techniques. A Tibetan master says, "Whenever I see someone, may I never feel superior. From the depth of my heart, may I be able to really appreciate the other person in front of me." Sometimes you tell me to act
like a holy man.
Yes, like a holy man.
Yes, yes. I mean, people expect that you would have a presence and behave properly, not take my cap and put it on your own head. I mean, people don't expect that from a holy man. But if you think you are just a normal person, one human being out of 7 billion, you see, there's no reason to be surprised or to feel like I should be something special. So whenever I'm with queens or kings or presidents or prime ministers or beggars, I always remember that we are all the same.
So when people treat you as His Holiness with such deference, I said, does that make it difficult to maintain your humility?
No, I don't care about a formality or protocol. These are artificial. Really, Bishop, you were born the same human way. There is no special way that bishops are born. And I think, when the end comes, also, you will die as a normal human being.
Yes, but when people come into your presence, they don't come as they come into my presence.
That, I think, is because I come from mysterious land, Tibet. Some people call Tibet Shangri-La. So perhaps a person who spent many years in Potala is sort of mysterious. When I think of these days, you see Chinese hardliners always criticize me. So that also makes more publicity. So these...
The Archbishop cut him off.
You see, that's exactly what I mean. You laugh at what would normally be a source of anguish. And people say, I hope that when I have some anguish in my life, I can respond in the way that I saw the Dalai Lama respond to how the Chinese treated him. How are you able to cultivate it? How did you cultivate it? You were not born like that.
That's true. It was through training and also the good fortune of receiving my mother's love. When I was young, I never saw my mother's angry face. She was very, very kind, but my father had a very short temper. On a few occasions, I even got his blessing.
The Dalai Lama made the gesture of being slapped.
When I was young, I followed my father's way, remaining quite short-tempered. But as I got a little older, then I began to take after my mother's way. So that way I lived up to the expectation of both my parents.
The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were both insistent that humility is essential to any possibility of joy. When we have a wider perspective, we have a natural understanding of our place in the great sweep of all that was, is, and will be. This naturally leads to humility and the recognition that as human beings, we can't solve everything or control all aspects of life. We need others. The Archbishop has poignantly said that our vulnerabilities, our frailties, and our limitations are a reminder that we need one another. We are not created for independence or self-sufficiency, but for interdependence and mutual support. The Dalai Lama was saying that we are all born and all die in the same way, and at these moments we are totally dependent on others, whether we are a Dalai Lama or a beggar, whether we are an archbishop or a refugee. With the keen insight of a longtime friend and collaborator, Daniel Goleman characterized the Dalai Lama's attitude toward life. The Dalai Lama seems amused by everything that is going on around him, taking pleasure in whatever is going on, but not taking anything too personally, and not worrying or taking offense at anything that is happening. The Dalai Lama was reminding us throughout the week not to get caught up in roles, and indeed arrogance is the confusion between our temporary roles and our fundamental identity. When Juan, our sound technician, wired up his remote microphone, the Dalai Lama playfully pulled on Juan's Don Quixote beard, which would start everyone giggling, most of all the Dalai Lama. He was saying, "Today you are the sound technician, and I am the Dalai Lama. Next time, maybe the roles will be reversed. Next time might be another year or another life, as the idea of reincarnation does remind us that all of our roles are temporary." The word humility actually comes from the Latin word for earth or soil, humus, which sounds a lot like but should not be confused with the simple but delicious Middle Eastern chickpea dip, hummus. Humility literally brings us back down to earth, sometimes with a thud. The Archbishop tells the story of flying from Durban to Johannesburg during the anti-apartheid struggle. A flight attendant said that one of the passengers had asked if he would autograph a book. He recalls, "I tried to look humble and modest, although I was thinking in my heart that there were some people who recognized a good thing when they saw it." But when she handed him the book and he took out his pen, she said, "You are Bishop Muzarewa, aren't you?" None of us are immune to the all-too-human traits of pride or ego. But true arrogance really comes from insecurity. Needing to feel that we are bigger than others comes from a nagging fear that we are smaller. Whenever the Dalai Lama senses this danger, he looks at a bug or some other creature and reminds himself that in some ways this creature is better than we are, because it is innocent and free of malice. When we realize that we are all children of God, the Archbishop has explained, and of equal and intrinsic value, then we don't have to feel better or worse than others. The Archbishop was adamant, no one is a divine accident. While we may not be special, we are essential, No one can fulfill our role but us in the divine plan or karmic unfolding.
Sometimes we confuse humility with timidity. This gives little glory to the one who has given us our gifts. Humility is a recognition that your gifts are from God, and this lets you sit relatively loosely to those gifts. Humility allows us to celebrate the gifts of others, but it does not mean you have to deny your own gifts or shrink from using them. God uses each of us in our own way. And even if you are not the best one, you may be the one who is needed, or the one who is there.
I recalled how the night before the interviews began, I had tossed and turned in bed, feeling quite insecure and nervous. I was going to have to interview these two great spiritual teachers and needed to make sure I was asking the right questions. We had one opportunity to get this right, and one opportunity to capture this historic meeting and series of dialogues for the world. I was not a news anchor or journalist. Surely there were many others who were more qualified to conduct the interviews. I was attempting to do something I had never done before. And whenever we challenge ourselves, fear and doubt are inevitable. I'm not sure we ever vanquish these voices. Whenever we are at the edge of our ability and experience, they always whisper in our ears their worried words. I have come to see that these voices are actually trying to keep us safe, as they warn us away from the unfamiliar and the unknown. But this does not make their daggers of self-doubt any less painful. I finally was able to fall asleep when I realized that this was not about me or my limitations. I was simply the ambassador asking questions on behalf of all those who wanted to benefit from the wisdom of the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama. And I would not be alone during the interviews or in the writing of this book. As the Archbishop had said, whether I was the best one or not, I was the one who was there. "We have a question from a boy named Emery," I said. "It is addressed to you, Your Holiness." He writes, "Your quotes always lift me up and give me purpose when I am down on myself. What is the best way to keep a positive attitude when things aren't going your way?" So here's a boy who gets down on himself the way we all do. How can we deal with the self-critical voices that we all have?
So many people seem to struggle with being kind to themselves. This is really sad. You see, if you don't have genuine love and kindness toward yourself, how can you extend these to others? We must remind people, as the Archbishop has said, that basic human nature is good, is positive, so this can give us some courage and self-confidence. As we said, too much focus on yourself leads to fear, insecurity, and anxiety. Remember, you are not alone. You are part of a whole generation that is the future of humanity. Then you will get a sense of courage and purpose in life. Now, we should also realize that the recognition of our own limitations and weaknesses can be very positive. This can be wisdom. If you realize that you are inadequate in some way, then you develop effort. If you think everything is fine and I'm okay just as I am, then you will not try to develop further. There's a Tibetan saying that wisdom is like rainwater. Both gather in the low places. There's another saying that when the spring bloom comes, where does it start? Does it start on the hilltops or down in the valleys first? Growth begins first in the low places. So similarly, if you remain humble, then there is a possibility to keep learning. So I often tell people that although I'm 80 years old, I still consider myself a student.
Really?
Really. Every day, learning, learning.
Yes, you are wonderful.
Oh, I expect that kind of comment from you.
The Archbishop laughed too, trying to keep himself humble. When we have humility, we can laugh at ourselves. It was surprising to hear the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama describe the importance of a proper sense of humor, and especially the ability to laugh at our own foibles, as essential to the cultivation of joy. Pillar 3. Humor. Laughter, joking, is much better. One of the most stunning aspects of the week was how much of it was spent laughing. At times, the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop seemed to be as much a comedy duo as two venerable spiritual teachers. It is their ability to joke and laugh and poke fun at the ordinary pieties that so righteously violates expectation. When a Dalai Lama and an Archbishop walk into a bar, you don't expect them to be the ones cracking the jokes. Having worked with many spiritual leaders, I'm tempted to see laughter and a sense of humor as a universal index of spiritual development. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were certainly at the top of that index, and they skewered humbug, status, injustice, and evil, all with the power of humor. They and everyone around them were constantly guffawing, chortling, giggling, and belly-laughing throughout the week, as moments of great levity were spliced together with moments of profundity and sanctity. So often their first response to any subject, no matter how seemingly painful, was to laugh. It was clear that humor was central to their joyful way of being. But why was laughter so central? I worked with a Mexican shaman once, I said, introducing the topic. He said that laughing and crying are the same thing. Laughing just feels better. It's clear that laughter is central to the way that you are in the world. And the Archbishop was just saying, Your Holiness, that you laugh at something that could ordinarily be a source of anguish.
That's right. That's right.
Can you tell us about the role of laughter and humor in the cultivation of joy?
It is much better when there is not too much seriousness. Laughter, joking is much better. Then we can be completely relaxed. I met some scientists in Japan, and they explain that wholehearted laughter, not artificial laughter, is very good for your heart and health in general.
When he said artificial laughter, he pretended to smile and forced a chuckle. He was making a connection between wholehearted laughter and a warm heart, which he had already said was the key to happiness. I once heard that laughter was the most direct line between any two people, and certainly the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop used humor to break down the social barriers that separate us. Humor, like humility, comes from the same root word for humanity, humus. The lowly and sustaining earth is the source for all three words. Is it any surprise that we have to have a sense of humility to be able to laugh at ourselves, and that to laugh at ourselves reminds us of our shared humanity?
I think that the scientists are right. People who are always laughing have a sense of abandon and ease. They are less likely to have a heart attack than those people who are really serious and who have difficulty connecting with other people. Those serious people are in real danger.
We found at home, when we were conducting funerals of people who had been killed by the police, we would have hundreds and hundreds of people attending the funerals. It was a state of emergency. You were not allowed any other gatherings, so the funerals turned into political rallies. We found that one of the best ways of helping our people direct their energies in positive directions was laughter. Telling jokes, even at our expense, was such a wonderful flip to our morale. Of course, some of the things that happened were just so horrendous. Like I was saying yesterday about Chris Honey, humor helped to diffuse a very, very tense situation. Telling stories that made people laugh, and especially to laugh at themselves. People were really angry, and you'd have the police standing not far away, and it was an explosive situation. Anything could have gone wrong. My weaponry, if you can call it that, was almost always to use humor, and especially self-denigrating humor, where you are laughing at yourself. We came to a township just outside of Johannesburg, where the apartheid forces had provided weaponry to one group, and they had killed quite a number of people. We were having a meeting of bishops close by, and I was part of those leading the funeral of the victims of that massacre. The people were obviously extremely angry. And I remembered a story that had been told about how at the beginning of creation, God molded us out of clay, and then put us into a kiln like you do with bricks. God put one lot in and then got busy with other things, and forgot about those he had put into the kiln. And after a while he remembered and rushed to the kiln, where the whole lot was burned to cinders. They say, this is how we black people came about. Everyone laughed a little. And then I said, next, God put in a second lot. And this time, he was over-anxious and opened the oven too quickly. And this second lot that came out was underdone. And that's how white people came about.
The Archbishop finished with a little laugh, and then that cackle that climbs up the flagpole and back down.
We tend to want to blow ourselves up, inflate ourselves, because most of us have tended to have a poor self-image. When you're in a situation such as the one in South Africa, where you were discriminated against, it was very easy to lose your sense of self, and humor seems to do something for people. Humor certainly did one good thing. It deflated, diffused, a particularly tense situation.
The Archbishop had visited Rwanda shortly after the genocide and was asked to give a talk to the Hutus and the Tutsis. How does one talk about a wound that is so fresh in the soul of a people? The Archbishop's solution, as it so often is, was to speak truth to power through humor. He began telling a story about the big-nose people and the small-nose people, and how the big-nose people were excluding the small-nose people. The people in the audience were laughing, and as they were laughing, they suddenly realized what he was talking about. The ridiculousness of prejudice and hatred, whether in his country or theirs. Humor was, as he said, a very powerful weapon. The Dalai Lama visited Belfast in Northern Ireland after the Troubles. He was invited to attend a private meeting where victims and perpetrators of violence were present. The atmosphere was very tense, as the suffering was practically palpable in the air. As the meeting began, a former Protestant militant spoke of how, when he was growing up, he was told by other loyalists that what they did in opposition to the Catholics was justified because Jesus was a Protestant and not a Catholic. Knowing that Jesus was, of course, a Jew, the Dalai Lama laughed so hard that he completely changed the atmosphere. Able to laugh at the absurdity of our prejudices and our hatreds, everyone was able to communicate more honestly and compassionately with each other.
When we learn to take ourselves slightly less seriously, then it is a very great help. We can see the ridiculous in us. I was helped by the fact that I came out of a family who did like to take the mickey out of others, and who were quite fond of pointing out the ridiculous, especially when someone was being a bit hoity-toity, and they had a way of puncturing your sense of self-importance. I mean, of course, it's not a laughing matter not to know where your next meal is going to come from. It's not a laughing matter when you get up in the morning and you don't have a job. Yet it was those people who quite frequently were the ones who formed part of the crowds that used to come to the political rallies, the funerals. And they were the people who were able to laugh at themselves. And then their laughing at others would be less malicious. They weren't particularly number one in God's garden, but they were able to laugh at life in all its cruelty and uncertainty. Humor really is the saving grace. I have been helped by my wife Leah, who was very, is very, good at keeping me humble. Once we were driving and I noticed that she was a little smugger than she normally is. And then, when I looked again at the car in front of us, I saw a bumper sticker that said, "Any woman who wants to be equal to a man has no ambition."
Archbishop, I said, humor can also be very cruel. But your humor, as I have seen over the years, is about bringing us together, not about separating us and putting anyone down, except maybe the Dalai Lama. But most of the time, it's about uniting. Can you tell us a little bit about the ways in which humor can bring us together and show us our shared ridiculousness?
Well, yes. If you are longing to bring people together, you're not going to do so by being acerbic. You know, it's so good to see the ridiculous in us, really. I think we then get to see our common humanity in many ways. Ultimately, I think it's about being able to laugh at yourself and being able not to take yourself so seriously. It's not about the belittling humor that puts others down and yourself up. It's about bringing people onto common ground. If you can manage to downgrade yourself, if you are able to laugh at yourself and get others to laugh at you without feeling guilty that they are laughing at you, the humor that doesn't demean is an invitation to everyone to join in the laughter. Even if they're laughing at you, they're joining you in a laughter that feels wholesome.
When you and the Dalai Lama tease each other, I added, it does not feel demeaning at all.
Yes, the Dalai Lama and I tease each other, but it is a statement of trust in the relationship. It's an indication that there's enough of a reservoir of goodwill that you're really saying, "I trust you, and you trust me, that I know you will not undermine me or be offended by me." I'm just thinking that we're so very apt to belittle because we are also so unsure of ourselves, and we think that the best way of asserting who we are is by putting you down. Whereas this kind of humor says, "Come, stand next to me and let's laugh at me together. Then we can laugh at you together." It does not belittle either of us, but uplifts us, allows us to recognize and laugh about our shared humanity, about our shared vulnerabilities, our shared frailties. Life is hard, you know, and laughter is how we come to terms with all the ironies and cruelties and uncertainties that we face.
Scientific research on humor is rather limited, but it does seem that there is an evolutionary role for laughter and humor in managing the anxiety and stress of the unknown. Jokes are funny precisely because they break our expectations and help us to accept the unexpected. Other people are one of the greatest sources of uncertainty in our lives, so it is not surprising that much humor is used to manage and massage these encounters. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are masters of using humor to connect and join together when meeting others. Perhaps that is one of the reasons that their time together was so filled with laughter. For all the joy they felt being together, it was an unprecedented and no doubt uncertain experience to meet for a week together in Dharamsala. They had met only a half dozen times before, and these were largely brief and formal occasions. Global leaders have full schedules, and their times together are highly scripted, so an opportunity to just joke and be themselves was exceedingly rare. "What do you say to people," I asked the Archbishop, "who say they are not funny or that they do not have a good sense of humor?"
"I reckon there are many people who think they have to be somber because it gives them gravitas, and they feel they are more likely to be respected if they are serious. But I believe very fervently that one of the ways of getting into the hearts of people is the capacity of making them laugh. If you are able to laugh at yourself, then everyone knows you're not pompous. Besides, you hardly ever knock down someone who is knocking himself down. You're not likely to clobber someone if they've already, as it were, self-clobbered. I don't think I woke up and Presto, I was funny. I think it is something that you can cultivate. Like anything else, it is a skill. Yes, it does help if you have the inclination, and especially if you can laugh at yourself. So learn to laugh at yourself. It's really the easiest place to begin. It's about humility. Laugh at yourself and don't be so pompous and serious. If you start looking for the humor in life, you will find it. You will stop asking, why me? And start recognizing that life happens to all of us. It makes everything easier, including your ability to accept others and accept all that life will bring.
Pillar 4. Acceptance. The only place where change can begin. When we had visited the Tibetan children's village in January, we noticed a wall displaying a quote that the Dalai Lama referenced in the dialogues. It was a translation of Shantideva's famous questions that His Holiness had mentioned, only in a slightly different translation. Why be unhappy about something if it can be remedied? And what is the use of being unhappy if it cannot be remedied? In this short teaching is the profound essence of the Dalai Lama's approach to life. It was at the root of his stunning ability to accept the reality of his exile without, as the Archbishop put it, being morose. Once we can see life in its wider perspective, once we are able to see our role in its drama with some degree of humility, and once we are able to laugh at ourselves, we then come to the fourth and final quality of mind, which is the ability to accept our life in all its pain, imperfection, and beauty. Acceptance, it must be pointed out, is the opposite of resignation and defeat. The Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are two of the most tireless activists for creating a better world for all of its inhabitants, but their activism comes from a deep acceptance of what is. The Archbishop did not accept the inevitability of apartheid, but he did accept its reality.
We are meant to live in joy. This does not mean that life will be easy or painless. It means that we can turn our faces to the wind and accept that this is the storm we must pass through. We cannot succeed by denying what exists. The acceptance of reality is the only place from which change can begin.
The Archbishop had said that when one grows in the spiritual life, you are able to accept anything that happens to you. You accept the inevitable frustrations and hardships as part of the warp and woof of life. The question, he had said, is not, how do we escape it? The question is, how can we use this as something positive? The Archbishop's prayer practice involves reading quotations from the scriptures, as well as quotes from the saints and spiritual masters throughout history. One of his favorites is the Christian mystic Julian of Norwich, whose Revelations of Divine Love, penned shortly after she recovered from a life-threatening illness in 1373, is believed to be the first book written by a woman in the English language. In it, she writes, "Deeds are done which appear so evil to us, and people suffer such terrible evils that it does not seem as though any good will ever come of them. And we consider this, sorrowing and grieving over it, so that we cannot find peace in the blessed contemplation of God as we should do. And this is why our reasoning powers are so blind now, so humble and so simple, that we cannot know the high, marvelous wisdom, the might and the goodness of the Holy Trinity. And this is what he means where he says, you shall see for yourself that all manner of things shall be well. As if he said, pay attention to this now, faithfully and confidently, and at the end of time you will truly see it in the fullness of joy. Acceptance, whether we believe in God or not, allows us to move into the fullness of joy. It allows us to engage with life on its own terms, rather than rail against the fact that life is not as we would wish. It allows us not to struggle against the day-to-day current. the Dalai Lama had told us that stress and anxiety come from our expectations of how life should be. When we are able to accept that life is how it is, not as we think it should be, we are able to ease the ride to go from the bumpy axle of dukkha, with all its suffering, stress, anxiety, and dissatisfaction, to the smooth axle, sukha, with its greater ease, comfort, and happiness. So many of the causes of suffering come from our reacting to the people, places, things, and circumstances in our lives, rather than accepting them. When we react, we stay locked in judgment, criticism, anxiety and despair, even denial and addiction. It is impossible to experience joy when we are stuck this way. Acceptance is the sword that cuts through all of this resistance, allowing us to relax, to see clearly, and to respond appropriately. Much of traditional Buddhist practice is directed toward the ability to see life accurately, beyond all the expectations, projections, and distortions that we typically bring to it. Meditative practice allows us to quiet the distracting thoughts and feelings so that we can perceive reality and respond to it more skillfully. The ability to be present in each moment is nothing more and nothing less than the ability to accept the vulnerability, discomfort, and anxiety of everyday life.
With deeper understanding of reality, you can go beyond appearances and relate to the world in a much more appropriate, effective, and realistic manner. I often give the example of how we should relate to our neighbors. Imagine that you are living next to a difficult neighbor. You can judge and criticize them. You can live in anxiety and despair that you will never have a good relationship with them. You can deny the problem or pretend that you do not have a difficult relationship with your neighbor. None of these is very helpful. Instead, you can accept that your relationship with your neighbor is difficult and that you would like to improve it. You may or may not succeed, but all you can do is try. You cannot control your neighbor, but you do have some control over your thoughts and feelings. Instead of anger, instead of hatred, instead of fear, you can cultivate compassion for them. You can cultivate kindness toward them. You can cultivate warm-heartedness toward them. This is the only chance to improve the relationship. In time, maybe they will become less difficult. Maybe not. This you cannot control, but you will have your peace of mind. You will be able to be joyful and happy whether your neighbor becomes less difficult or not.
We come back to the beginning of our discussion and Shantideva's questions. The kind of acceptance that the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop were advocating is not passive. It is powerful. It does not deny the importance of taking life seriously and working hard to change what needs changing, to redeem what needs redemption.
You must not hate those who do harmful things. The compassionate thing is to do what you can to stop them, for they are harming themselves as well as those who suffer from their actions.
One of the key paradoxes in Buddhism is that we need goals to be inspired, to grow and to develop, even to become enlightened. But at the same time, we must not get overly fixated or attached to these aspirations. If the goal is noble, your commitment to the goal should not be contingent on your ability to attain it. And in pursuit of our goal, we must release our rigid assumptions about how we must achieve it. Peace and equanimity come from letting go of our attachment to the goal and the method. That is the essence of acceptance. Reflecting on this seeming paradox of pursuing a goal yet with no attachment to its outcome, Jinpa explained to me that there is an important insight. This is a deep recognition that while each of us should do everything we can to realize the goal we seek, whether or not we succeed often depends on many factors beyond our control, So our responsibility is to pursue the goal with all the dedication we can muster. Do the best we can, but not become fixated on a preconceived notion of a result. Sometimes, actually quite often, our efforts lead to an unexpected outcome that might even be better than what we originally had in mind. I thought of the Archbishop's comment that it takes time to build our spiritual capacity.
It's like muscles that have to be exercised in order for them to be strengthened. Sometimes we get too angry with ourselves, thinking that we ought to be perfect from the word go. But this being on earth is a time for us to learn to be good, to learn to be more loving, to learn to be more compassionate. And you learn, not theoretically. You learn when something happens that tests you.
Life is constantly unpredictable, uncontrollable, and often quite challenging. Edith Eva Eger explained that life in a concentration camp was an endless selection line where one never knew whether one would live or die. The only thing that kept a person alive was the acceptance of the reality of one's existence and the attempt to respond as best one could. Curiosity about what would happen next, even when she was left for dead in a pile of bodies, was often all she had to pull herself forward to the next breath. When we accept what is happening now, we can be curious about what might happen next. Acceptance was the final pillar of the mind, and it led us to the first pillar of the heart, forgiveness. When we accept the present, we can forgive and release the desire for a different past. Pillar 5, forgiveness, freeing ourselves from the past.
I have seen remarkable instances of forgiveness carried out by people we would not have thought could possibly do it. In one instance, during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, we had mothers of some young people who had been lured by those working with the apartheid system into a booby trap where they were killed. One of the mothers said she switched on her television set and saw the body of her son being dragged. And apart from her anguish at the death of her son, there was a deep, deep anger at his body being treated as if it were the carcass of an animal. You know, when these mothers came to the commission, they were quite amazing, really, because no one demanded that they should forgive these people. They called them askaris, who were formerly members of the African National Congress, who then turned and supported the government forces. The one who betrayed these young people came and appeared in front of these mothers and asked for their forgiveness. When the mother of the young man who had been dragged through the street saw the traitor, she took off her shoe and threw it at him. We had to adjourn for a little while, but then during the break came a totally fantastic moment as they sat there, and their spokesperson said, "My child." She said, "My child," to this one who had been responsible for the death of their children. She said, "My child, we forgive you." When we asked her about the granting of amnesty, she said, "What is it going to help us if he were to go to prison? It won't bring back our children." And there is an incredible kind of nobility and strength. Yes, it's difficult, but it has happened. We talked about Nelson Mandela, but there were these mothers and many others who were not household names, who had this magnanimity. In this group of mothers, the one who was speaking on their behalf got up and went across the room to this guy who had been responsible for the killing of their sons and embraced him and said, "My child." Just recently, I got a message about a white woman named Beth who was badly maimed in a bomb attack by one of the liberation movements and still had shrapnel in her body. many of her friends were killed, and many were also maimed. She had to be helped by her children to eat, to be bathed. Beth was just, I'm overcome. Beth said, about the perpetrator, I forgive him, and I hope he forgives me.
Then the Archbishop told the well-known story about one of my college classmates, Amy Beale, who had gone down to South Africa after graduating from university to try to help. She was brutally killed while dropping off one of her friends in a township.
Her parents came all the way from California to South Africa to support the granting of amnesty to the perpetrators who had been sentenced to heavy terms of imprisonment. They said, "We want to be part of the process of healing in South Africa. We are sure that our daughter would support us in saying we want amnesty to be granted to the murderers." And more than this, they set up a foundation in their daughter's name and employed these men who had murdered their daughter in the project to help the people of that township. Now, I don't pretend that comes easily, but we do have a nobility of spirit. We've spoken of Nelson Mandela as an amazing icon of forgiveness, but you and you and you and you have the potential to be instruments of incredible compassion and forgiveness. We cannot say of anyone at all that they are totally unable to forgive. I think that all of us have the latent potential, as His Holiness is pointing out, to be sorry for these others who are disfiguring their humanity in this way. Indeed, no one is incapable of forgiving, and no one is unforgivable.
I want to mention one of my friends from Northern Ireland, Richard Moore. His story is very, very touching. He was age 9 or 10 during the Troubles in Northern Ireland when a British soldier shot him with a rubber bullet as he was on his way to school. He fainted, and when he recovered, he was at the hospital, having lost both of his eyes. He realized that he would no longer be able to see his mother's face. He continued studying, and eventually he got married and had 2 girls. Then he found the British soldier who shot him in the head so he could communicate his forgiveness. They became very good friends, and on one occasion, at my personal invitation, they both came to Dharamsala. I wanted Richard to share his deeply moving story of forgiveness with Tibetans, especially the students at the Tibetans' children's village. In introducing Richard Moore to the students and teachers there, I mentioned that he is my hero. Then Richard invited me to visit Northern Ireland. And when I saw him with his family there, I teased him. "Your wife is very beautiful. Your 2 daughters are also very beautiful. But you can't see. I can, so I can enjoy seeing their beauty." I describe him as my real hero. That's really a human being.
Your Holiness, this brings us to a question from a boy named Jack, who writes, "Your Holiness, I wish you a happy 80th birthday from the bottom of my heart. I hope that your next year is full of joy, success, and many great things. I have the utmost respect for you and your people and for your undying message of kindness and forgiveness. Yet I wonder, can you forgive China for all of the harm and pain they have caused you and your people? Do they deserve it? Thank you, Your Holiness, and have a wonderful birthday." The Dalai Lama's hands were pressed together as if in prayer as he began.
The other day, I mentioned the 10th of March 2008, when spontaneous protests began in Tibet. I deliberately tried to keep compassion and a sense of concern for the Chinese hardliners. I tried to take their anger, their fear, into myself and give them my love, my forgiveness. This is our practice of taking and giving, of Tonglen. It was really very helpful to keep my mind calm. In our struggle, we deliberately try to stop ourselves from developing anger or hatred. Of course, the Chinese are a wonderful people, but even for the hardliners, the officials, we deliberately try to keep a sense of compassion, sense of concern for their well-being. Generally, when we speak of cultivating compassion for someone, we are cultivating compassion for someone who is actually undergoing acute suffering and pain. But you can also develop compassion for someone who may not be experiencing acute pain or suffering right now, but who is creating the conditions for their own future suffering. So you see, these people are committing such negative actions, committing harmful acts that create a lot of pain for others. In the Christian tradition, don't you say they will go to hell?
The Archbishop nodded, listening.
In our view, also those people who are committing atrocities, including murder, are creating karma that brings very serious negative consequences. So there are many reasons to feel a sense of real concern for their well-being. When you have a sense of concern for their well-being, then there is no place for anger and hatred to grow.
Forgiveness does not mean that we forget. You should remember the negative thing, but because there is a possibility to develop hatred, we mustn't allow ourselves to be led in that direction. We choose forgiveness.
The Archbishop was also clear about this. Forgiveness does not mean you forget what someone has done, contrary to the saying, forgive and forget. Not reacting with negativity or giving in to the negative emotions does not mean you do not respond to the acts or that you allow yourself to be harmed again. Forgiveness does not mean that you do not seek justice or that the perpetrator is not punished. The Dalai Lama has chosen not to react out of anger and hatred, but that isn't to say he won't speak out against the Chinese occupation and what they are doing inside Tibet until the Tibetan people can live with dignity and freedom.
I would like to add that there is an important distinction between forgiveness and simply allowing others wrongdoing. Sometimes people misunderstand and think forgiveness means you accept or approve of wrongdoing. No, this is not the case. We must make an important distinction. The actor and action, or the person and what he has done. Where the wrong action is concerned, it may be necessary to take appropriate counteraction to stop it. Toward the actor or the person, however, you can choose not to develop anger and hatred. This is where the power of forgiveness lies, not losing sight of the humanity of the person while responding to the wrong with clarity and firmness. We stand firm against the wrong not only to protect those who are being harmed, but also to protect the person who is harming others, because eventually they too will suffer. So it's out of a sense of concern for their own long-term well-being that we stop their wrongdoing. This is exactly what we are doing. We do not let anger and negative feelings develop toward the Chinese hardliners, but in the meantime, we strongly oppose their actions.
Forgiveness is the only way to heal ourselves and to be free from the past.
As the Archbishop Enimpa explained in the Book of Forgiving, without forgiveness, we remain tethered to the person who harmed us. We are bound to the chains of bitterness, tied together, trapped. Until we can forgive the person who harmed us, that person will hold the keys to our happiness. That person will be our jailer. When we forgive, we take back control of our own fate and our feelings. We become our own liberator. So what do you say to people, I asked the Dalai Lama, who say that forgiveness seems like weakness and revenge seems like strength?
There are certain people who act out of the animal mind. When someone hits them, they want to hit back, retaliate. With our human brain, we can think, if I hit back, what use will it be in the short term or in the long term? We can also realize that obviously nobody was born to be cruel, to harm us. But because of certain circumstances, now he or she dislikes me, so hits me. Perhaps my behavior or attitude or even my facial expression contributed to this person becoming my enemy. So I was also involved. Who is to blame? So sitting and thinking of the different causes and conditions, then you see that if we are really angry, we must be angry toward the causes and conditions. Ultimately, their anger, their ignorance, their short-sightedness, their narrow-mindedness. So that brings a sense of concern, and we can feel sorry for these people. So it is totally wrong to say that practice of tolerance and practice of forgiveness are signs of weakness. Totally wrong. 100% wrong. 1000% wrong. Forgiveness is a sign of strength, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I was just going to say that those who say forgiving is a sign of weakness haven't tried it. The natural response when someone hits you is wanting to hit back. But why do we admire people who don't choose revenge? It is our recognition of the fact that, yes, there are those who think an eye for an eye is going to satisfy you, but in the end, you discover that an eye for an eye will leave the whole world blind. We have an instinct for revenge, but also for forgiveness.
Indeed, it seems like humans evolved with both impulses and both capacities, for revenge and for forgiveness. When psychologists Martin Daly and Margot Wilson studied 60 different cultures around the world, they found that 95% had some form of blood revenge. When psychologist Michael McCullough looked at the same cultures, he found that 93% of them also displayed some examples of forgiveness or reconciliation. Forgiveness may actually be so common that it is taken for granted in the other 7%. Primatologist Franz De Waal believes that such peacemaking activities are extremely common in the animal kingdom. Chimps kiss and make up. And it seems that many other species do as well. Not only apes like us, but also sheep, goats, hyenas, and dolphins. Of the species that have been studied, only domestic cats have failed to show behavior that reconciles relationships after conflict. This finding will not surprise anyone who has cats. In the Book of Forgiving, the Archbishop and Mpaw outline two cycles, the cycle of revenge and the cycle of forgiveness. When a hurt or harm happens, we can choose to hurt back or to heal. If we choose to retaliate or pay back, the cycle of revenge and harm continues endlessly. But if we choose to forgive, we break the cycle and we can heal, renewing or releasing the relationship. Unforgiveness leads to ongoing feelings of resentment, anger, hostility, and hatred that can be extremely destructive. Even short bursts of it can have significant physical effects. In one study, psychologist Charlotte Van Ooyen-Witvillet asked people to think about someone who had hurt, mistreated, or offended them. She monitored their heart rate, facial muscles, and sweat glands. When people remembered their grudges, they had a stress response. Their blood pressure and heart rate increased, and they began to sweat. They felt sad, angry, intense, and less in control. When they were asked to empathize with their offenders and to imagine forgiving them, their stress responses returned to normal. As social animals, it is very stressful for us and for the whole group when there is rupture in the relationships that bind us together. In a review of the research on forgiveness and health, Everett L. Worthington Jr. and Michael Schurer found that unforgiveness seems to compromise the immune system in a number of ways, including disrupting the production of important hormones and the way that our cells fight off infections. I want to just come back to you, Archbishop, for our final question before tea, I said. Often the people that we have the hardest time forgiving are the people who are closest to us.
Yes, yes.
You have told me that forgiving your father for some of the things that he did to your mother was very difficult for you and very painful for you. And I wonder, if he were here with us, how would you tell him how that affected you, and how you would tell him that you forgave him? What would you say?
Well, I would certainly tell him that I was deeply hurt by how he treated my mother when he was drunk. I was very angry with myself for being too small to beat him up. I mean, when he was sober, he was a wonderful person. But my mother was... I just adored my mother. She was just such an incredible human being, a very gentle person. And that just made it worse. And there was a son too small to intervene when she was being roughed up. I should tell you one great regret I have. We used to take the children to boarding school in Swaziland, about 300 miles each way, and we would overnight on the way at our parents' because there were no motels where blacks could stay. On this particular time, when we were returning from Swaziland, we were going to put up at Leah's home with her mother, which was not in the same township where my parents lived. We had come to say goodnight and goodbye to my parents, because we were going to leave early to go down to the Cape, where I was working. And on this particular occasion, I was dead exhausted when my father said he wanted to talk to me. There was something he wanted to tell me. I was too tired and I was headachy, and I said, "No, can we talk tomorrow?" And we left to go to Leia's home. And, as sometimes happens only in novels, we were awoken early in the morning by my niece telling us that my father had died the previous evening. And so, I've never known what it was he wanted to tell me. I have a very deep regret. I sometimes shed a tear or two. I hope it was that maybe he had a premonition of his death and wanted to say how sorry he was for the treatment that he had meted out to my mother. And so I regret that. I can only say, I hope he rests in peace. I have to accept that I missed an opportunity, which was not to come back. None of us actually ever knows when it's going to be that moment when something quite crucial might in fact be going to happen, and we turn our back on it. And yes, I try to assuage my guilt, but it can't go away completely. The fact is, he had taken the initiative, and whatever justification I had, it's an initiative that I spurned, and it is a burden on my heart and my spirit, and I can only hope that he will have forgiven me. Yeah.